expected it. The couple diligently avoided Baltimore society. When visitors came unannounced to their mansion on the hill, the maid was told to inform them that the Halsteads were not home. With the world around him erased and silenced by this routine and rhythm, Halsted now attacked breast cancer with relentless energy. At Volkmann's clinic in Halle, Halsted had witnessed the German surgeon performing increasingly meticulous and aggressive surgeries to remove tumors from the breast. But Volkmann, Halsted knew, had run into a wall. Even though the surgeries had grown extensive and exhaustive, breast cancer had still relapsed, eventually recurring months or even years after the operation. What caused this relapse? At St. Luke's Hospital in London in the 1860s, the English surgeon Charles Moore had also noted these vexing local recurrences. Frustrated by repeated failures, Moore had begun to record the anatomy of each relapse, denoting the area of the original tumor, the precise margin of the surgery, and the site of cancer recurrence by drawing tiny black dots on a diagram of a breast, creating a sort of historical dartboard of cancer recurrence. And to Moore's surprise, dot by dot, a pattern had emerged. The recurrences had accumulated precisely around the margins of the original surgery, as if minute remnants of cancer had been left behind by incomplete surgery and grown back. Mammary cancer requires the careful extirpation of the entire organ, Moore concluded. Local recurrence of cancer after operations is due to the continuous growth of fragments of the principal tumor. Moore's hypothesis had an obvious corollary. If breast cancer relapsed due to the inadequacy of the original surgical excisions, then even more breast tissue should be removed during the initial operation. Since the margins of extirpation were the problem, then why not extend the margins? Moore argued that surgeons, attempting to spare women the disfiguring and often life-threatening surgery, were exercising mistaken kindness, letting cancer get the better of their knives. In Germany, Halsted had seen Volkmann remove not just the breast, but a thin, fan-like muscle spread out immediately under the breast, called the pectoralis minor, in the hopes of cleaning out the minor fragments of leftover cancer. Halsted took this line of reasoning to its next inevitable step. Volkmann may have run into a wall. Halsted would excavate his way past it. Instead of stripping away the thin pectoralis minor, which had little function, Halsted decided to dig even deeper into the breast cavity, cutting through the pectoralis major, the large, prominent muscle responsible for moving the shoulder and the hand. Halsted was not alone in this innovation. Willie Meyer, a surgeon operating in New York, independently arrived at the same operation in the 1890s. Halsted called this procedure the radical mastectomy, using the word radical in the original Latin sense to mean root. He was uprooting cancer from its very source. But Halsted, evidently scornful of mistaken kindness, did not stop his surgery at the pectoralis major. When cancer still recurred despite his radical mastectomy, he began to cut even farther into the chest. By 1898, Halsted's mastectomy had taken what he called an even more radical turn. Now he began to slice through the collarbone, reaching for a small cluster of lymph nodes that lay just underneath it. We clean out or strip the supraclavicular fossa with very few exceptions, he announced at a surgical conference, reinforcing the notion that conservative, non-radical surgery left the breast somehow unclean. At Hopkins, Halsted's diligent students now raced to outpace their master with their own scalpels. Joseph Bloodgood, one of Halsted's first surgical residents, had started to cut farther into the neck to evacuate a chain of glands that lay above the collarbone. Harvey Cushing, another star apprentice, even cleaned out the anterior mediastinum, the deep lymph nodes buried inside the chest. It is likely, Halsted noted, that we shall, in the near future, remove the mediastinal contents at some of our primary operations. A macabre marathon was in progress. Halstead and his disciples would rather evacuate the entire contents of the body than be faced with cancer recurrences. In Europe, one surgeon evacuated three ribs and other parts of the rib cage and amputated a shoulder and a collarbone from a woman with breast cancer. Halstead acknowledged the physical penalty of his operation. The mammoth mastectomies permanently disfigured the bodies of his patients. With the pectoralis major cut off, the shoulders caved inward as if in a perpetual shrug, making it impossible to move the arm forward or sideways. Removing the lymph nodes under the armpit often disrupted the flow of lymph, causing the arm to swell up with accumulated fluid like an elephant's leg, a condition he vividly called surgical elephantiasis. Recuperation from surgery often took patients months, even years. Yet Halstead accepted all these consequences as if they were the inevitable war wounds in an all-out battle. "The patient was a young lady whom I was loath to disfigure," he wrote with genuine concern, describing an operation extending all the way into the neck that he had performed in the 1890s. Something tender, almost paternal, appears in his surgical notes, with outcomes scribbled alongside personal reminiscences. "Good use of arm. Chops wood with it. No swelling," he wrote at the end of one case. "Married. 4 children, he scribbled in the margins of another. But did the Halstead mastectomy save lives? Did radical surgery cure breast cancer? Did the young woman that he was so loath to disfigure benefit from the surgery that had disfigured her? Before answering those questions, it's worthwhile understanding the milieu in which the radical mastectomy flourished. In the 1870s, when Halstead had left for Europe to learn from the great masters of the art, surgery was a discipline emerging from its adolescence. By 1898, it had transformed into a profession booming with self-confidence, a discipline so swooningly self-impressed with its technical abilities that great surgeons unabashedly imagined themselves as showmen. The operating room was called an operating theater, and surgery was an elaborate performance often watched by a tense, hushed audience of observers from an oculus above the theater. "To watch Halstead operate," one observer wrote in 1898, "was to watch the performance of an artist close akin to the patient and minute labor of a Venetian or Florentine intaglio cutter or a master worker in mosaic." Halstead welcomed the technical challenges of his operation, often conflating the most difficult cases with the most curable. "I find myself inclined to welcome largeness of a tumor," he wrote, challenging cancer to duel with his knife. But the immediate technical success of surgery was not a predictor of its long-term success, its ability to decrease the relapse of cancer. Halstead's mastectomy may have been a Florentine mosaic worker's operation, but if cancer was a chronic relapsing disease, then perhaps cutting it away, even with Halstead's intaglio precision, was not enough. To determine whether Halstead had truly cured breast cancer, one needed to track not immediate survival, or even survival over 5 or 10 months, but survival over 5 or 10 years. The procedure had to be put to a test by following patients longitudinally in time. So in the mid-1890s, at the peak of his surgical career, Halstead began to collect long-term statistics to show that his operation was the superior choice. By then, the radical mastectomy was more than a decade old. Halstead had operated on enough women and extracted enough tumors to create what he called an entire cancer storehouse at Hopkins. Halstead would almost certainly have been right in his theory of radical surgery, that attacking even small cancers with aggressive local surgery was the best way to achieve a cure. But there was a deep conceptual error. Imagine a population in which breast cancer occurs at a fixed incidence, say 1% per year. The tumors, however, demonstrate a spectrum of behavior right from their inception. In some women, by the time the disease has been diagnosed, the tumor has already spread beyond the breast. There is metastatic cancer in the bones, lungs, and liver. In other women, the cancer is confined to the breast, or to the breast and a few nodes. It is truly a local disease. Position Halstead now with his scalpel and sutures in the middle of this population, ready to perform his radical mastectomy on any woman with breast cancer. Halstead's ability to cure patients with breast cancer obviously depends on the sort of cancer, the stage of breast cancer, that he confronts. The woman with the metastatic cancer is not going to be cured by a radical mastectomy, no matter how aggressively and meticulously Halstead extirpates the tumor in her breast. Her cancer is no longer a local problem. In contrast, the woman with the small, confined cancer does benefit from the operation. But for her, a far less aggressive procedure, a local mastectomy, would have done just as well. Halstead's mastectomy is thus a peculiar misfit in both cases. It underestimates its target in the first case and overestimates it in the second. In both cases, women are forced to undergo indiscriminate, disfiguring, and morbid operations. Too much too early for the woman with local breast cancer, and too little too late for the woman with metastatic cancer. On April 19, 1898, Halstead attended the annual conference of the American Surgical Association in New Orleans. On the second day, before a hushed and eager audience of surgeons, he rose to the podium armed with figures and tables showcasing his highly anticipated data. At first glance, his observations were astounding. His mastectomy had outperformed every other surgeon's operation in terms of local recurrence. At Baltimore, Halstead had slashed the rate of local recurrence to a bare few percent, a drastic improvement on Folkman's or Billroth's numbers. Just as Halstead had promised, he had seemingly exterminated cancer at its root. But if one looked closely, the roots had persisted. The evidence for a true cure of breast cancer was much more disappointing. Of the 76 patients with breast cancer treated with the radical method, only 40 had survived for more than 3 years. 36, or nearly half the original number, had died within 3 years of the surgery, consumed by a disease supposedly uprooted from the body. But Halstead and his students remained unfazed. Rather than address the real question raised by the data, did radical mastectomy truly extend lives, they clutched to their theories even more adamantly. A surgeon should operate on the neck in every case, Halstead emphasized in New Orleans. Where others might have seen reason for caution, Halstead only saw opportunity. I fail to see why the neck involvement in itself is more serious than the axillary area. The neck can be cleaned out as thoroughly as the axilla. In the summer of 1907, Halstead presented more data to the American Surgical Association in Washington, D.C. He divided his patients into three groups based on whether the cancer had spread before surgery to lymph nodes in the axilla or the neck. When he put up his survival tables, a pattern became apparent. Of the 60 patients with no cancer-afflicted nodes in the axilla or the neck, the substantial number of 45 had been cured of breast cancer at 5 years. Of the 40 patients with such nodes, only 3 had survived. The ultimate survival from breast cancer, in short, had little to do with how extensively a surgeon operated on the breast. It depended on how extensively the cancer had spread before surgery. As George Crile, one of the most fervent critics of radical surgery, later put it, if the disease was so advanced that one had to get rid of the muscles in order to get rid of the tumor, then it had already spread through the system, making the whole operation moot. But if Halstead came to the brink of this realization in 1907, he just as emphatically shied away from it. he relapsed to stale aphorisms. But even without the proof which we offer, it is, I think, incumbent upon the surgeon to perform in many cases the supraclavicular operation, he advised in one paper. By now, the perpetually changing landscape of breast cancer was beginning to tire him out. Trials, tables, and charts had never been his forte. He was a surgeon, not a bookkeeper. It is especially true of mammary cancer, he wrote, that the surgeon interested in furnishing the best statistics may in perfectly honorable ways provide them. That statement, almost vulgar by Halsted standards, exemplified his growing skepticism about putting his own operation to a test. He instinctively knew that he had come to the far edge of his understanding of this amorphous illness that was constantly slipping out of his reach. The 1907 paper was to be Halsted's last and most comprehensive discussion on breast cancer. He wanted new and open anatomical vistas where he could practice his technically brilliant procedures in peace, not debates about the measurement and remeasurement of endpoints of surgery. Never having commanded a particularly good bedside manner, he retreated fully into his cloistered operating room and into the vast, cold library of his mansion. He had already moved on to other organs, the thorax, the thyroid, the great arteries, where he continued to make brilliant surgical innovations. But he never wrote another scholarly analysis of the majestic and flawed operation that bore his name. Between 1891 and 1907, in the 16 hectic years that stretched from the tenuous debut of the radical mastectomy in Baltimore to its center stage appearances at vast surgical conferences around the nation, the quest for a cure for cancer took a great leap forward and an equally great step back. Halsted proved beyond any doubt that massive, meticulous surgeries were technically possible in breast cancer. These operations could drastically reduce the risk for the local recurrence of a deadly disease. But what Halsted could not prove, despite his most strenuous efforts, was far more revealing. After nearly two decades of data gathering, having been levitated, praised, analyzed, and reanalyzed in conference after conference, the superiority of radical surgery in curing cancer still stood on shaky ground. More surgery had just not translated into more effective therapy. Yet all this uncertainty did little to stop other surgeons from operating just as aggressively. Radicalism became a psychological obsession, burrowing its way deeply into cancer surgery. Even the word radical was a seductive conceptual trap. Halsted had used it in the Latin sense of root, because his operation was meant to dig out the buried, subterranean roots of cancer. But radical also meant aggressive, innovative, and brazen, and it was this meaning that left its mark on the imaginations of patients. What man or woman confronting cancer would willingly choose non-radical or conservative surgery? Indeed, radicalism became central not only to how surgeons saw cancer, but also in how they imagined themselves. With no protest from any other quarter and nothing to stand in its way, the practice of radical surgery, one historian wrote, soon fossilized into dogma. When heroic surgery failed to match its expectations, some surgeons began to shrug off the responsibility of a cure altogether. Undoubtedly, if operated upon properly, the condition may be cured locally, and that is the only point for which the surgeon must hold himself responsible, one of Halsted's disciples announced at a conference in Baltimore in 1931. The best a surgeon could do, in other words, was to deliver the most technically perfect operation. Curing cancer was someone else's problem. This trajectory toward more and more brazenly aggressive operations, the more radical the better, mirrored the overall path of surgical thinking of the early 1930s. In Chicago, the surgeon Alexander Brunschwig devised an operation for cervical cancer called a complete pelvic extenturation, so strenuous and exhaustive that even the most Halstedian surgeon needed to break mid-procedure to rest and change positions. The New York surgeon George Pack was nicknamed Pack the Knife after the popular song Mac the Knife, as if the surgeon and his favorite instrument had, like some sort of ghoulish centaur, somehow fused into the same creature. Cure was a possibility now flung far into the future. Even in its widest sense, an English surgeon wrote in 1929, the measure of operability depends on the question, is the lesion removable, and not on the question, is the removal of the lesion going to cure the patient? Surgeons often counted themselves lucky if their patients merely survived these operations. There is an old Arabian proverb, a group of surgeons wrote at the end of a particularly chilling discussion of stomach cancer in 1933, that he is no physician who has not slain many patients, and the surgeon who operates for carcinoma of the stomach must remember that often. To arrive at that sort of logic, the Hippocratic Oath turned upside down demands either a terminal desperation or a terminal optimism. In the 1930s, the pendulum of cancer surgery swung desperately between those two points. Halsted, Brunschwig, and Pack persisted with their mammoth operations because they genuinely believed that they could relieve the dreaded symptoms of cancer. But they lacked formal proof, and as they went further up the isolated promontories of their own beliefs, proof became irrelevant and trials impossible to run. The more fervently surgeons believed in the inherent good of their operations, the more untenable it became to put these to a formal scientific trial. Radical surgery thus drew the blinds of circular logic around itself for nearly a century. The allure and glamour of radical surgery overshadowed crucial developments in less radical surgical procedures for cancer that were evolving in its penumbra. Halsted's students fanned out to invent new procedures to extirpate cancers. Each was assigned an organ. Halsted's confidence in his heroic surgical training program was so supreme that he imagined his students capable of confronting and annihilating cancer in any organ system. In 1897, having intercepted a young surgical resident, Hugh Hampton Young, in a corridor at Hopkins, Halsted asked him to become the head of the new Department of Urological Surgery. Young protested that he knew nothing about urological surgery. "I know you didn't know anything," Halsted replied curtly, "but we believe that you can learn," and walked on. Inspired by Halsted's confidence, Young delved into surgery for urological cancers, cancers of the prostate, kidney, and bladder. In 1904, with Halsted as his assistant, Young successfully devised an operation for prostate cancer by excising the entire gland. Although called the radical prostatectomy in the tradition of Halsted, Hampton's surgery was rather conservative by comparison. He did not remove muscles, lymph nodes, or bone. He retained the notion of the en bloc removal of the organ from radical surgery, but stopped short of evacuating the entire pelvis or extirpating the urethra or the bladder. A modification of this procedure is still used to remove localized prostate cancer, and it cures a substantial portion of patients with such tumors. Harvey Cushing, Halsted's student and chief surgical resident, concentrated on the brain. By the early 1900s, Cushing had found ingenious ways to surgically extract brain tumors, including the notorious glioblastomas, tumors so heavily crisscrossed with blood vessels that they could hemorrhage any minute, and meningiomas, wrapped like sheaths around delicate and vital structures in the brain. Like Young, Cushing inherited Halsted's intaglio surgical technique, the slow separation of brain from tumor, working now here, now there, leaving small flattened pads of hot, wrung-out cotton to control oozing. But not Halsted's penchant for radical surgery. Indeed, Cushing found radical operations on brain tumors not just difficult, but inconceivable. Even if he desired it, a surgeon could not extirpate the entire organ. In 1933, at the Barnes Hospital in St. Louis, yet another surgical innovator, Evarts Graham, pioneered an operation to remove a lung afflicted with cancer by piecing together prior operations that had been used to remove tubercular lungs. Graham, too, retained the essential spirit of Halstedian surgery, the meticulous excision of the organ en bloc, and the cutting of wide margins around the tumor to prevent local recurrences. But he tried to sidestep its pitfalls. Resisting the temptations to excise more and more tissue, lymph nodes throughout the thorax, major blood vessels, or the adjacent fascia around the trachea and esophagus, he removed just the lung, keeping the specimen as intact as possible. Even so, obsessed with Halstedian theory and unable to see beyond its realm, surgeons sharply berated such attempts at non-radical surgery. A surgical procedure that did not attempt to obliterate cancer from the body was poo-pooed as a makeshift operation. To indulge in such makeshift operations was to succumb to the old flaw of mistaken kindness that a generation of surgeons had tried so diligently to banish. The hard tube and the weak light. We have found in X-rays a cure for the malady. Los Angeles Times, April 6, 1902. By way of illustration of the destructive power of X-rays, let us recall that nearly all pioneers in the medical X-ray laboratories in the United States died of cancers induced by the burns. The Washington Post, 1945. In late October 1895, a few months after Halstead had unveiled the radical mastectomy in Baltimore, Wilhelm Röntgen, a lecturer at the Würzburg Institute in Germany, was working with an electron tube, a vacuum tube that shot electrons from one electrode to another, when he noticed a strange leakage. The radiant energy was powerful and invisible, capable of penetrating layers of blackened cardboard and producing a white phosphorescent glow on a barium screen accidentally left on a bench in the room. Röntgen whisked his wife, Anna, into the lab and placed her hand between the source of his rays and a photographic plate. The rays penetrated through her hand and left a silhouette of her finger bones and her metallic wedding ring on the photographic plate, the inner anatomy of a hand seen as if through a magical lens. "I have seen my death," Anna said. But her husband saw something else, a form of energy so powerful that it could pass through most living tissues. Röntgen called his form of light X-rays. At first, X-rays were thought to be an artificial quirk of energy produced by electron tubes. But in 1896, just a few months after Röntgen's discovery, Henri Becquerel, the French chemist who knew of Röntgen's work, discovered that certain natural materials, uranium among them, autonomously emitted their own invisible rays with properties similar to those of X-rays. In Paris, friends of Becquerel's, a young physicist-chemist couple named Pierre and Marie Curie, began to scour the natural world for even more powerful chemical sources of X-rays. Pierre and Marie, then Maria Sklodowska, a penniless Polish immigrant living in a garret in Paris, had met at the Sorbonne and been drawn to each other because of a common interest in magnetism. In the mid-1880s, Pierre Curie had used minuscule quartz crystals to craft an instrument called an electrometer, capable of measuring exquisitely small doses of energy. Using this device, Marie had shown that even tiny amounts of radiation emitted by uranium ores could be quantified. With their new measuring instrument for radioactivity, Marie and Pierre began hunting for new sources of X-rays. Another monumental journey of scientific discovery was thus launched with measurement. In a waste ore called pitchblende, a black sludge that came from the peaty forests of Joachimstal in what is now the Czech Republic, the Curies found the first signal of a new element, an element many times more radioactive than uranium. the Curies set about distilling the boggy sludge to trap that potent radioactive source in its purest form. From several tons of pitchblende, 400 tons of washing water, and hundreds of buckets of distilled sludge waste, they finally fished out 0.1 gram of the new element in 1902. The metal lay on the far edge of the periodic table, emitting X-rays with such feverish intensity that it glowered with a hypnotic blue light in the dark, consuming itself. Unstable, it was a strange chimera between matter and energy, matter decomposing into energy. Marie Curie called the new element radium, from the Greek word for light. Radium, by virtue of its potency, revealed a new and unexpected property of X-rays. They could not only carry radiant energy through human tissues, but also deposit energy deep inside tissues. Röntgen had been able to photograph his wife's hand because of the first property. His X-rays had traversed through flesh and bone and left a shadow of the tissue on the film. Marie Curie's hands, in contrast, bore the painful legacy of the second effect. Having distilled pitchblende into a millionth part for week after week in the hunt for purer and purer radioactivity, the skin in her palm had begun to chafe and peel off in blackened layers, as if the tissue had been burnt from the inside. A few milligrams of radium left in a vial in Pierre's pocket scorched through the heavy tweed of his waistcoat and left a permanent scar on his chest. One man who gave magical demonstrations at a public fair with a leaky, unshielded radium machine developed swollen and blistered lips, and his teeth and nails fell out. Radiation would eventually burn into Marie Curie's bone marrow, leaving her permanently anemic. It would take biologists decades to fully decipher the mechanism that lay behind these effects. But the spectrum of damaged tissues, skin, lips, blood, gums, and nails, already provided an important clue. Radium was attacking DNA. DNA is an inert molecule, exquisitely resistant to most chemical reactions, for its job is to maintain the stability of genetic information. But X-rays can shatter strands of DNA, or generate toxic chemicals that corrode DNA. Cells respond to this damage by dying, or more often, by ceasing to divide. X-rays thus preferentially kill the most rapidly proliferating cells in the body, cells in the skin, nails, gums, and blood. This ability of X-rays to selectively kill rapidly dividing cells did not go unnoticed, especially by cancer researchers. In 1896, barely a year after Röntgen had discovered his X-rays, a 21-year-old Chicago medical student, Emil Grube, had the inspired notion of using X-rays to treat cancer. Flamboyant, adventurous, and fiercely inventive, Grube had worked in a factory in Chicago that produced vacuum X-ray tubes, and he had built a crude version of a tube for his own experiments. Having encountered X-ray-exposed factory workers with peeling skin and nails, his own hands had also become chapped and swollen from repeated exposures, Grube quickly extended the logic of this cell death to tumors. On March 29, 1896, in a tube factory on Halsted Street, the name bears no connection to Halsted the surgeon, in Chicago, Grube began to bombard Rose Lee, an elderly woman with breast cancer, with radiation using an improvised X-ray tube. Lee's cancer had relapsed after a mastectomy, and the tumor had exploded into a painful mass in her breast. She had been referred to Grube as a last-ditch measure, more to satisfy his experimental curiosity than to provide any clinical benefit. Grube looked through the factory for something to cover the rest of the breast, and finding no sheet of metal, wrapped Lee's chest in some tin foil that he found in the bottom of a Chinese tea box. He irradiated her cancer every night for 18 consecutive days. The treatment was painful, but somewhat successful. The tumor in Lee's breast ulcerated, tightened, and shrank, producing the first documented local response in the history of X-ray therapy. A few months after the initial treatment, though, Lee became dizzy and nauseated. The cancer had metastasized to her spine, brain, and liver, and she died shortly after. Grube had stumbled on another important observation. X-rays could only be used to treat cancer locally, with little effect on tumors that had already metastasized. Metastatic sites of cancer can occasionally be treated with X-rays, although with limited success. Inspired by the response, even if it had been temporary, Grube began using X-ray therapy to treat scores of other patients with local tumors. A new branch of cancer medicine, radiation oncology, was born, with X-ray clinics mushrooming up in Europe and America. By the early 1900s, less than a decade after Röntgen's discovery, doctors waxed ecstatic about the possibility of curing cancer with radiation. "I believe this treatment is an absolute cure for all forms of cancer," a Chicago physician noted in 1901. "I do not know what its limitations are." With the Curie's discovery of radium in 1902, surgeons could beam thousandfold more powerful bursts of energy on tumors. Conferences and societies on high-dose radiation therapy were organized in a flurry of excitement. Radium was infused into gold wires and stitched directly into tumors to produce even higher local doses of X-rays. Surgeons implanted radon pellets into abdominal tumors. By the 1930s and 40s, America had a national surplus of radium, so much so that it was being advertised for sale to laypeople in the back pages of journals. Vacuum tube technology advanced in parallel. By the mid-1950s, variants of these tubes could deliver blisteringly high doses of X-ray energy into cancerous tissues. Radiation therapy catapulted cancer medicine into its atomic age, an age replete with both promise and peril. Certainly the vocabulary, the images, and the metaphors bore the potent symbolism of atomic power unleashed on cancer. There were cyclotrons and super voltage rays and linear accelerators and neutron beams. One man was asked to think of his X-ray therapy as millions of tiny bullets of energy. Another account of a radiation treatment is imbued with the thrill and horror of a space journey. The patient is put on a stretcher that is placed in the oxygen chamber. As a team of six doctors, nurses, and technicians hover at chamberside, the radiologist maneuvers a betatron into position. After slamming shut a hatch at the end of the chamber, technicians force oxygen in. After 15 minutes under full pressure, the radiologist turns on the betatron and shoots radiation at the tumor. Following treatment, the patient is decompressed in deep-sea diver fashion and taken to the recovery room. Stuffed into chambers, herded in and out of hatches, hovered upon, monitored through closed-circuit television, pressurized, oxygenated, decompressed, and sent back to a room to recover, patients weathered the onslaught of radiation therapy as if it were an invisible benediction. And for certain forms of cancer, it was a benediction. Like surgery, radiation was remarkably effective at obliterating locally confined cancers. Breast tumors were pulverized with X-rays. Lymphoma lumps melted away. One woman with a brain tumor woke up from her year-long coma to watch a basketball game in her hospital room. But like surgery, radiation medicine also struggled against its inherent limits. Emil Grube had already encountered the first of these limits with his earliest experimental treatments. Since X-rays could only be directed locally, radiation was of limited use for cancers that had metastasized. Radiation can be used to control or palliate metastatic tumors in selected cases, but is rarely curative in these circumstances. One could double and quadruple the doses of radiant energy, but this did not translate into more cures. Instead, indiscriminate irradiation left patients scarred, blinded, and scalded by doses that had far exceeded tolerability. The second limit was far more insidious. Radiation produced cancers. The very effect of X-rays killing rapidly dividing cells, DNA damage, also created cancer-causing mutations in genes. In the 1910s, soon after the Curies had discovered radium, a New Jersey corporation called U.S. Radium began to mix radium with paint to create a product called Undark, radium-infused paint that emitted a greenish-white light at night. Although aware of the many injurious effects of radium, U.S. Radium promoted Undark for clock dials, boasting of glow-in-the-dark watches. Watch painting was a precise and artisanal craft, and young women with nimble, steady hands were commonly employed. These women were encouraged to use the paint without precautions and to frequently lick the brushes with their tongues to produce sharp lettering on watches. Radium workers soon began to complain of jaw pain, fatigue, and skin and tooth problems. In the late 1920s, medical investigations revealed that the bones in their jaws had necrosed, their tongues had been scarred by irradiation, and many had become chronically anemic, a sign of severe bone marrow damage. Some women, tested with radioactivity counters, were found to be glowing with radioactivity. Over the next decades, dozens of radium-induced tumors sprouted in these radium-exposed workers, sarcomas and leukemias, and bone, tongue, neck, and jaw tumors. In 1927, a group of five severely afflicted women in New Jersey, collectively termed radium girls by the media, sued U.S. Radium. None of them had yet developed cancers. They were suffering from the more acute effects of radium toxicity, jaw, skin, and tooth necrosis. A year later, the case was settled out of court with a compensation of $10,000 each to the girls, and $600 per year to cover living and medical expenses. The compensation was not widely collected. Many of the radium girls, too weak even to raise their hands to take an oath in court, died of leukemia and other cancers soon after their case was settled. Marie Curie died of leukemia in July 1934. Emil Grube, who had been exposed to somewhat weaker X-rays, also succumbed to the deadly late effects of chronic radiation. By the mid-1940s, Grube's fingers had been amputated one by one to remove necrotic and gangrenous bones, and his face was cut up in repeated operations to remove radiation-induced tumors and pre-malignant warts. In 1960, at the age of 85, he died in Chicago with multiple forms of cancer that had spread throughout his body. The complex intersection of radiation with cancer, cancer curing at times, cancer causing at others, dampened the initial enthusiasm of cancer scientists. Radiation was a powerful, invisible knife, but still a knife. And a knife, no matter how deft or penetrating, could only reach so far in the battle against cancer. A more discriminating therapy was needed, especially for cancers that were non-localized. In 1932, Willie Meyer, the New York surgeon who had invented the radical mastectomy contemporaneously with Halsted, was asked to address the annual meeting of the American Surgical Association. Gravely ill and bedridden, Meyer knew he would be unable to attend the meeting, but he forwarded a brief 6-paragraph speech to be presented. On May 31st, 6 weeks after Meyer's death, his letter was read aloud to the roomful of surgeons. There is, in that letter, an unfailing recognition that cancer medicine had reached some terminus, that a new direction was needed. If a biological systemic after-treatment were added in every instance, Meyer wrote, we believe the majority of such patients would remain cured after a properly conducted radical operation. Meyer had grasped a deep principle about cancer. Cancer, even when it begins locally, is inevitably waiting to explode out of its confinement. By the time many patients come to their doctor, the illness has often spread beyond surgical control and spilled into the body exactly like the black bile that Galen had envisioned so vividly nearly 2,000 years ago. In fact, Galen seemed to have been right after all. In the accidental, aphoristic way that Democritus had been right about the atom, or Erasmus had made a conjecture about the Big Bang centuries before the discovery of galaxies. Galen had, of course, missed the actual cause of cancer. There was no black bile clogging up the body and bubbling out into tumors in frustration. But he had uncannily captured something essential about cancer in his dreamy and visceral metaphor. Cancer was often a humoral disease. Crab-like and constantly mobile, it could burrow through invisible channels from one organ to another. It was a systemic illness, just as Galen had once made it out to be. Dying and dying. Those who have not been trained in chemistry or medicine may not realize how difficult the problem of cancer treatment really is. It is almost, not quite, but almost, as hard as finding some agent that will dissolve away the left ear, say, and leave the right ear unharmed. So slight is the difference between the cancer cell and its normal ancestor. William Wauglum. Life is a chemical incident. Paul Ehrlich, as a schoolboy, 1870. A systemic disease demands a systemic cure, but what kind of systemic therapy could possibly cure cancer? Could a drug, like a microscopic surgeon, perform an ultimate pharmacological mastectomy, sparing normal tissue while excising cancer cells? Willie Meyer wasn't alone in fantasizing about such a magical therapy. Generations of doctors before him had also fantasized about such a medicine. But how might a drug coursing through the whole body specifically attack a diseased organ? Specificity refers to the ability of any medicine to discriminate between its intended target and its host. Killing a cancer cell in a test tube is not a particularly difficult task. The chemical world is packed with malevolent poisons that, even in infinitesimal quantities, can dispatch a cancer cell within minutes. The trouble lies in finding a selective poison, a drug that will kill cancer without annihilating the patient. Systemic therapy without specificity is an indiscriminate bomb. For an anti-cancer poison to become a useful drug, Meyer knew, it needed to be a fantastically nimble knife, sharp enough to kill cancer, yet selective enough to spare the patient. The hunt for such specific systemic poisons for cancer was precipitated by the search for a very different sort of chemical. The story begins with colonialism and its chief loot, cotton. In the mid-1850s, as ships from India and Egypt, laden with bales of cotton, unloaded their goods in English ports, cloth milling boomed into a spectacularly successful business in England, an industry large enough to sustain an entire gamut of subsidiary industries. A vast network of mills sprouted up in the industrial basin of the Midlands, stretching through Glasgow, Lancashire, and Manchester. Textile exports dominated the British economy. Between 1851 and 1857, the export of printed goods from England more than quadrupled, from 6 million to 27 million pieces per year. In 1784, cotton products had represented a mere 6% of total British exports. By the 1850s, the proportion had peaked at 50%. The cloth milling boom set off a boom in cloth dyeing, but the two industries, cloth and color, were oddly out of technological step. Dyeing, unlike milling, was still a pre-industrial occupation. Cloth dyes had to be extracted from perishable vegetable sources, rusty carmines from Turkish madder root, or deep blues from the indigo plant, using antiquated processes that required patience, expertise, and constant supervision. Printing on textiles with colored dyes to produce the ever-popular calico prints, for instance, was even more challenging, requiring thickeners, mordants, and solvents in multiple steps, and often took the dyers weeks to complete. The textile industry thus needed professional chemists to dissolve its bleaches and cleansers, to supervise the extraction of dyes, and to find ways to fasten the dyes on cloth. A new discipline called practical chemistry, focused on synthesizing products for textile dyeing, was soon flourishing in polytechnics and institutes all over London. In 1856, William Perkin, an 18-year-old student at one of these institutes, stumbled on what would soon become a holy grail of this industry, an inexpensive chemical dye that could be made entirely from scratch. In a makeshift one-room laboratory in his apartment in the East End of London, half of a small but long-shaped room with a few shelves for bottles and a table, Perkin was boiling nitric acid and benzene in smuggled glass flasks and precipitated an unexpected reaction. A chemical had formed inside the tubes with the color of pale, crushed violets. In an era obsessed with dye-making, any colored chemical was considered a potential dye, and a quick dip of a piece of cotton into the flask revealed the new chemical could color cotton. Moreover, this new chemical did not bleach or bleed. Perkin called it aniline mauve. Perkin's discovery was a godsend for the textile industry. Aniline mauve was cheap and imperishable, vastly easier to produce and store than vegetable dyes. As Perkin soon discovered, its parent compound could act as a molecular building block for other dyes, a chemical skeleton on which a variety of side chains could be hung to produce a vast spectrum of vivid colors. By the mid-1860s, a glut of new synthetic dyes in shades of lilac, blue, magenta, aquamarine, red, and purple flooded the cloth factories of Europe. In 1857, Perkin, barely 19 years old, was inducted into the Chemical Society of London as a full fellow, one of the youngest in its history to be thus honored. Aniline mauve was discovered in England, but dye-making reached its chemical zenith in Germany. In the late 1850s, Germany, a rapidly industrializing nation, had been itching to compete in the cloth markets of Europe and America. But unlike England, Germany had scarcely any access to natural dyes. By the time it had entered the scramble to capture colonies, the world had already been sliced up into so many parts, with little left to divide. German cloth millers thus threw themselves into the development of artificial dyes, hoping to rejoin an industry that they had once almost given up as a lost cause. Dye-making in England had rapidly become an intricate chemical business. In Germany, goaded by the textile industry, cosseted by national subsidies, and driven by an expansive economic growth, synthetic chemistry underwent an even more colossal boom. In 1883, the German output of alizarin, the brilliant red chemical that imitated natural carmine, reached 12,000 tons, dwarfing the amount being produced by Perkin's factory in London. German chemists rushed to produce brighter, stronger, cheaper chemicals and muscled their way into textile factories all around Europe. By the mid-1880s, Germany had emerged as the champion of the chemical arms race, which presaged a much uglier military one, to become the dye basket of Europe. Initially, the German textile chemists lived entirely in the shadow of the dye industry. But emboldened by their successes, the chemists began to synthesize not just dyes and solvents, but an entire universe of new molecules. Phenols, alcohols, bromides, alkaloids, alizarins, and amides. Chemicals never encountered in nature. By the late 1870s, synthetic chemists in Germany had created more molecules than they knew what to do with. Practical chemistry had become almost a caricature of itself, an industry seeking a practical purpose for the products that it had so frantically raced to invent. Early interactions between synthetic chemistry and medicine had largely been disappointing. Gideon Harvey, a 17th century physician, had once called chemists the most impudent, ignorant, flatulent, fleshy, and vainly boasting sort of mankind. The mutual scorn and animosity between the two disciplines had persisted. In 1849, August Hoffman, William Perkins' teacher at the Royal College, gloomily acknowledged the chasm between medicine and chemistry. None of these compounds have, as yet, found their way into any of the appliances of life. We have not been able to use them for curing disease. But even Hoffman knew that the boundary between the synthetic world and the natural world was inevitably collapsing. In 1828, a Berlin scientist named Friedrich Wöhler had sparked a metaphysical storm in science by boiling ammonium cyanate, a plain inorganic salt, and creating urea, a chemical typically produced by the kidneys. The Wöhler experiment, seemingly trivial, had enormous implications. Urea was a natural chemical, while its precursor was an inorganic salt. That a chemical produced by natural organisms could be derived so easily in a flask threatened to overturn the entire conception of living organisms. For centuries, the chemistry of living organisms was thought to be imbued with some mystical property, a vital essence that could not be duplicated in a laboratory, a theory called vitalism. Wöhler's experiment demolished vitalism. Organic and inorganic chemicals, he proved, were interchangeable. Biology was chemistry. Perhaps even a human body was no different from a bag of busily reacting chemicals, a beaker with arms, legs, eyes, brain, and soul. With vitalism dead, the extension of this logic to medicine was inevitable. If the chemicals of life could be synthesized in a laboratory, could they work on living systems? If biology and chemistry were so interchangeable, could a molecule concocted in a flask affect the inner workings of a biological organism? Wöhler was a physician himself, and with his students and collaborators, he tried to backpedal from the chemical world into the medical one. But his synthetic molecules were still much too simple, mere stick figures of chemistry where vastly more complex molecules were needed to intervene on living cells. But such multifaceted chemicals already existed. The laboratories of the dye factories of Frankfurt were full of them. To build his interdisciplinary bridge between biology and chemistry, Wöhler only needed to take a short day trip from his laboratory in Göttingen to the labs of Frankfurt. But neither Wöhler nor his students could make that last connection. The vast panel of molecules sitting idly on the shelves of the German textile chemists, the precursors of a revolution in medicine, may as well have been a continent away. It took a full 50 years after Wöhler's urea experiment for the products of the dye industry to finally make physical contact with living cells. In 1878, in Leipzig, a 24-year-old medical student, Paul Ehrlich, hunting for a thesis project, proposed using cloth dyes, aniline and its colored derivatives, to stain animal tissues. At best, Ehrlich hoped that the dyes might stain the tissues to make microscopy easier. But to his astonishment, the dyes were far from indiscriminate darkening agents. Aniline derivatives stained only parts of the cell, silhouetting certain structures and leaving others untouched. The dyes seemed able to discriminate among chemicals hidden inside cells, binding some and sparing others. This molecular specificity, encapsulated so vividly in that reaction between a dye and a cell, began to haunt Ehrlich. In 1882, working with Robert Koch, he discovered yet another novel chemical stain, this time for mycobacteria, the organisms that Koch had discovered